Hello, my name is Chip Lang, and you are listening to Total EM. For podcast number 244, we are going to talk about an updated set of guidelines for anorectal emergencies from the World Journal of Emergency Surgery, which was also done in conjunction with the American Association for the Surgery of Trauma. And this podcast, if you go to the show notes at totalem.org, podcast number 244, you will find the PDF that I'm referring to. It's also available free and open access, but I want to make it as easy as possible, so I've included the PDF in the show notes as well. Also in the show notes, you'll see a detailed list of kind of the key points, the main topics and things that you need to know broken down for the emergencies that we're going to cover in this particular podcast, which includes anorectal abscess, perineal necrotizing fasciitis, also known as Fournier's gangrene, bleeding anorectal varices, complicated rectal prolapse, which is either irreducible or strangulated, and retained anorectal foreign bodies. Some of this is going to be very similar to what you learned in school. Some of this is going to be a little bit more updated, and we're going to talk about that more here as we go along. Let's start first with anorectal abscess. So you want to, of course, perform a complete examination, including a digital rectal exam. That's kind of part of their exam and labs portion, if you will. They also recommend checking a serum glucose, hemoglobin A1C, which in the emergency department side of things, you might order it, but you don't necessarily expect it to get back. It might help with the surgeon and or hospitals who will help manage this patient. You are also going to obtain urine ketones to help identify for undetected diabetes, as this is often an exacerbating factor. They also recommend that you assess for signs of systemic infection or sepsis, which includes a CBC, serum creatinine, and inflammatory markers, which they include as a CRP, procalcitonin, and lactate. The imaging that they recommend, MRI, CT, or endosonography, depending on what is available. Imaging is indicated for atypical presentations or in case of suspicion for occult supraalveolar abscesses, complex anal fistula, or perianal Crohn's disease. Endosonography, by the way, they talk about, they don't necessarily talk about ultrasound otherwise, which depending on the location, you might be able to actually use point of care ultrasound, but they don't specifically list it here. With surgical management, in fit, immunocompetent patients with a small perianal abscess and without systemic signs of sepsis, they consider outpatient management as an option. Otherwise, surgical IND is recommended with timing based on the presence and severity of sepsis. They make no recommendations regarding the packing after drainage, which I think is an interesting topic we've talked about further in other podcasts. There is also further management such as fistulotomy that may be needed in certain circumstances, which is broken down further in the actual paper. In regards to antibiotics, sampling of the drained pus in high-risk patients and or in the presence of risk factors for multi-drug resistance is recommended. Honestly, in my world, I think everyone should get the cultures done, and mainly that's because there's such a high rate of multi-drug resistance. And just given the fact of, you know, a lot of these patients, why risk not getting the culture unless you just, for whatever reason, can't, there's a technical issue, whatever. But otherwise, I just believe you probably should be getting cultures in each one of these patients, but that's me. In drained abscesses, it is recommended to administer antibiotics in the presence of sepsis, surrounding soft tissue infection, or in the case of disturbances of the immune response. The surrounding soft tissue infection, I feel like cellulitis occurs so often with these, but they do recommend that, you know, if any of these are present, to go ahead and administer antibiotics. We're going to move on to perineal necrotizing fasciitis, which again is known as Fournier's gangrene. Again, when it comes to the exam and labs, they talk about performing complete exam, including a digital rectal exam. They once again talk about checking for things that help with undetected diabetes, serum glucose, hemoglobin A1C, and urine ketones. They also suggest, again, checking a CBC, serum creatinine, electrolytes they add in this time, and inflammatory markers to look for signs of systemic infection or sepsis, which I find interesting that they now list electrolytes. They didn't before, but that's kind of a little bit different discussion. They also suggest using the Larynx score, which is the laboratory risk indicator for necrotizing fasciitis. And this is to help with early detection. There's also what's called the Fournier's gangrene severity index, which is meant to help with prognosis and risk stratification. I included in the show notes a link to this because this is something that's not on MDCalc, like the larynx score, which is again meant to help with early diagnosis. Imaging, they talk about in stable patients with suspected Fournier's gangrene to consider performing a CT, but that imaging should not delay surgical intervention. So for example, if you have to maybe get this patient transferred, it's going to take some time to get the patient transferred, or maybe you're going to take care of the patient locally because you have the surgeon who can help with this procedure, that maybe the CT is obtained right before the surgery, as long as it doesn't delay it. Again, that's something to talk about directly with your specialist. Many specialists, it seems like they want that CT done no matter what, which can be very frustrating. But they do recommend against obtaining imaging in patients with hemodynamic instability persisting after proper resuscitation. This, I think, is great for us because we can say, hey, your surgeon colleagues recommend not delaying this and hopefully kind of pushing things. With surgical management, the intervention should be performed as soon as possible with a plan on repeat surgical revisions according to patient condition, and that seriated surgical revisions are needed until the patient is free of necrotic tissue. This is very important, and this is something that we need to tell our patients that, hey, this is not a one-and-done surgery. This is usually going to be something that needs multiple surgeries, often over a prolonged period of time, until that can be completely taken care of, including removing all necrotic tissue. When it comes to antibiotics, they recommend that you start empiric antibiotics as soon as the diagnosis is suspected, and that antibiotics should provide coverage for gram-positive, gram-negative, aerobic and anaerobic, as well as anti-MRSA agents. So basically as broad spectrum as possible, and then to base antimicrobial de-escalation on clinical improvement, culture pathogens, and results of rapid diagnostic tests when available. We're going to move on to now bleeding anorectal varices. And again, examine labs-wise, they talk about a complete exam, including a digital rectal exam, which you're going to find pretty much is going to be true for almost all these cases. They also recommend checking vital signs, which I love because they don't talk about that with the other ones so far. Hemoglobin, hematocrit, and coagulation to evaluate for the severity of bleeding. Again, I just find interesting how they talk about some of these. And in the case of severe bleeding, perform blood typing and cross-matching, which I absolutely agree. Imaging, they talk about endosonography plus or minus Doppler as a second-line diagnostic tool, especially for deep rectal varices or when in doubt. And those with high-risk features or evidence of ongoing bleeding should have urgent colonoscopy and upper endoscopy. They do specifically mention that as well within 24 hours of presentation. If risk factors for colon cancer or suspicion for a concomitant, more proximal source of bleeding, full colonoscopy is suggested. Local procedures such as endoscopic variceal ligation, endoscopic band ligation, sclerotherapy, or endosonography-guided glue injection should be used to arrest bleeding in first instance where feasible. I found this really interesting because some of this stuff I didn't really know, and it's worth looking up to kind of get a better understanding about some of these procedures. Non-operative management includes a basically multidisciplinary approach, including early involvement of a hepatologist. For mild bleeding, they consider IV fluid replacement, blood transfusion if necessary, correction of coagulopathy, and optimal medication for portal hypertension. In severe bleeding, they want you to maintain a hemoglobin greater than 7 during the resuscitation phase and a mean arterial pressure greater than 65 millimeters mercury, but to avoid fluid overload. Again, you want to give blood products in these cases, and I think they beat around the bush a little bit, but because of this fact that it is worldwide, you know, they don't want to necessarily kind of tie people up with this. The hemoglobin part I also find interesting because if it's acutely bleeding, your hemoglobin may not drop right away. We got to look at the blood pressure, which at least acknowledge. Endorectal placement of a compression tube as a bridging maneuver is suggested to help stabilization of the patient or to allow for transfer to a tertiary hospital. So I'm glad they acknowledge that as well. Medications, they talk about non-selective beta-adrenergic blockers for prevention or prophylaxis. A first and or recurrent variceal bleeding is suggested. They also talk about in case of acute bleeding to temporarily suspend beta blockers. Also makes sense. Consider the use of vasoactive drugs such as terlipsin or octreotide to reduce splanchnic blood flow and portal pressure. Recommending also that you use a short course of prophylactic antibiotics. Now, the other part we need to consider is angiography and surgery. Again, with, you know, kind of all these cases, we can provide maybe some suggestions and it's good to know, but it's not like you're going to be doing the surgery yourself as the emergency medicine physician, PA, NP, whoever, as the one who's taking care of this patient. But they say if there is failure of medical treatment and local procedures, they suggest a step-up approach with radiological and then surgical procedures. Interventional radiology suggested to use embolization for short-term control of bleeding, as well as percutaneous tips, if not contraindicated, should be used to decompress the portal venous system and to reduce the risk of rebleeding. They talk about if these measures fail, that a per-anal suture ligation by surgery should be considered. They don't have any recommendations regarding the role of Doppler-guided hemorrhoidal artery ligation and stapled anopexy in patients with persistent bleeding failing other techniques. Which again, that's a lot more technical, but something that is worth knowing and at least having that kind of in the back burner to be familiar with should this situation arise and you might need to talk about this more with surgery and or IR. Moving on to complicated rectal prolapse, so irreducible or strangulated. Again, examine labs, they talk about performing a complete exam, including visualization of the area of concern. I kind of phrased it that way because they didn't talk about a rectal exam, which kind of makes sense if the rectum is prolapsed. But they do recommend to check a CBC, serum creatinine, and inflammatory markers, which again include CRP, procalcitonin, and lactate. Imaging in a hemodynamically stable patient, there should be an urgent contrast enhanced CT of the abdomen and pelvis to detect for associated complications and to assess the presence of colorectal cancer. They also talk about if hemodynamically unstable, not to delay appropriate and timely management with the imaging. Speaking of surgical management, if presenting with signs of shock or gangrene slash obstruction of the prolapsed bowel, immediate surgical treatment is recommended, which makes total sense. Again, we have to sometimes encourage our colleagues not to delay because of imaging in these cases. But in cases with acute bowel obstruction or failure of non-operative management, urgent surgical treatment is also suggested. When we talk about medications, they recommend administering empiric antibiotics because of the risk of intestinal bacterial translocation, which is a very good point. They also say that a specific regimen should be based on the clinical condition of the patient, risk of MDRO, which is multi-drug resistance organisms, and local resistance patterns, all of which, again, makes sense. Moving on to the last topic, and this is one that we can, you know, kind of talk all sorts about, but again, I'm just going to focus on the recommendations for this, and that's retained anorectal foreign bodies. As you may guess, again, with examined labs, perform a complete exam, including a digital rectal exam. But they do suggest that prior to performing the digital rectal exam, to obtain abdominal x-rays whenever possible to prevent any accidental injury from sharp objects, which I think is very, very valid. And I'm glad that they did include that in this case. They also talk about routine laboratory testing is not recommended if there are no signs of bowel perforation, but if there is failure of manual extraction or it's not feasible, then routine preoperative labs can be obtained. If there is suspected bowel perforation, obtain a CBC, serum creatinine, and inflammatory markers, which again are CRP, procalcitonin, and lactate. I do find it interesting they don't talk about ESR, which is estimated sedimentation rate at all, but this is specifically what they do list in the recommendations. Imaging-wise, they recommend obtaining lateral and anterior-posterior plain x-rays of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis to identify the foreign body position, shape, size, and location, as well as to evaluate for pneumoperitoneum, which again makes complete sense, but with suspected perforation, they recommend obtaining a CT of the abdomen and pelvis with contrast. In hemodynamically unstable patients, again, don't delay treatment with imaging. They do talk about non-operative and endoscopic management, for which this is where we are again going to be helpful. In low-lying retained foreign bodies without signs of perforation, attempt extraction at the bedside. This is a very uncomfortable procedure, by the way, so please consider sedation or very, very high-quality pain control in general. If unsuccessful, a pudendal nerve block, spinal anesthesia, IV conscious sedation, or general anesthesia may be used to improve chances of extraction, which the more aggressive you are about your sedation, the more relaxed you can get things, the easier it is to try and remove. And sometimes general anesthesia is just enough to get everything loose enough to get it out, when otherwise it wouldn't be possible. If the foreign body is high lying, attempt an endoscopic extraction being the first line option. But they also talk about, should drug concealment be suspected? So for example, you have, you know, sometimes what people refer to as mules, but someone who is carrying this in their body, an illicit substance, avoid any maneuvers that can disrupt the drug packaging, such as endoscopic retrieval, which I think is something that we can forget about sometimes. But if that bag opens up, that body is going to absorb it, and that can be a huge problem. So we need to remember that. They also talk about evaluating the bowel wall status after foreign body removal by proctoscopy or flexible sigmoidoscopy. And do not perform transanal extraction if there are signs of hemodynamic instability or perforation, because we're going to move on to surgical management. They again talk about if there is failure of transanal extraction, a step-up approach is recommended, starting with downward milking and proceeding to colotomy only when milking / transanal extraction has failed. If scales and tools are available, consider a laparoscopic approach if there is no perforation. They also talk about primary suture only in case of small and recent perforation if the colonic tissues appear healthy and well vascularized, with said approximation being without tension. This is something that we don't need to know directly, but I thought was good to include these things in there for completeness sake, because I do find this rather interesting. If the primary suture is not feasible, resection with primary anastomosis with or without diverting stoma should be used in clinically stable patients without risk factors for anastomic leakage. In critically ill patients, selected patients with extensive peritoneal contamination and risk factors for anastomic leakage, it is suggested to perform a Hartmann's procedure, which again, if you're interested in that, you can look that up separately because it's kind of an interesting process, but too hard to try and explain here. Patients that are hemodynamically unstable should have emergent laparotomy and damage control surgery, which I think is very interesting that they mentioned damage control surgery here. Sometimes that's also going to be referred to in that way when you're talking about Fournier's gangrene. Antibiotics, generally antimicrobial therapy is not recommended. However, if there are signs of hemodynamic instability or bowel perforation, broad spectrum antibiotic therapy should be given. And they talk about this according to the WSES guidelines on intra-abdominal infections being what they recommend, which is a little bit different than the others so far, but is good to know about. Hopefully this is something that will help you get a better idea of, again, some of the major emergencies that are surgical in nature that involve anorectal complaints. And I do think that we'll talk about some of the other ones later that maybe aren't necessarily the same kind of emergencies as we consider otherwise, such as like hemorrhoids, which there's been a lot of interesting changes there. If you want to learn or hear more about that, give me a shout out. Let me know. I can make that its own separate podcast. But until next time, continue to provide total care everywhere.